Hi, everyone, and welcome to Intuitive Awakening. My name is Dina. Thank you so much for joining me here today on this week's podcast. Last week, we reviewed the Kybalion, the first part of the Kybalion, and some of the sacred principles that are addressed in this text. We left off talking about this whole divine paradox that is addressed in this book, the whole idea that matter is illusory and real simultaneously. So we're going to pretty much pick up from where we left off. In the Kybalion, the next section that's addressed, after, you know, the Hermeticists address this whole paradoxical universe, the Kybalion, it next focuses on the creator, or quote-unquote God, using the same Hermetic principles, especially the whole principle of as above, so below, this very specific reasoning. So this next section that's addressed is called the All. And here's an example that I want to kind of use to kickstart this section. When an author creates a character, such as, let's say, Shakespeare creates a character, part of the author is in the character. In the same way that part of the creator is in each of us, very similarly. However, just as, let's say, Juliet, a Shakespeare character, isn't entirely Shakespeare, neither are we entirely the creator. We retain some part of us that's not identical with our creator. This is another divine paradox that's addressed in this book. We're simultaneously made in the image and not in the image of the creator or God. We would call this part of ourselves either, I guess you could say, the ego, or in some circles, and I believe this term was coined by Carl Jung, and I could be wrong there, but we could also call that part of our side, or ourselves, the shadow side. So the Kybalion, or the Hermeticists, excuse me, go on to address this next axiom, which is the following. While all is in the all, it is equally true that the all is in all. To him who truly understands this truth hath come great knowledge. So here's what the initiates have to say about this. We have given you the Hermetic teaching regarding the mental nature of the universe, the truth that the universe is mental, held in the mind of the all. Now let's examine the following quote from the Kybalion. All is in the all. It is equally true that the all is in all. This apparent contradictory statement is reconcilable under the law of paradox. Even more, it's an exact Hermetic statement of the relationship between the all and its mental universe. The all is omnipresent throughout every particle of the universe. It's much like a character in a novel. While reading the novel, the character seems to have a life force of its own. Yet the character also carries the essence of the author. In fact, the character's entire life and reality comes from the mental images of the author. The character, and just to use Shakespeare here, the characters Othello and Hamlet existed merely in the mind of Shakespeare at the time of their conception and creation. And yet, Shakespeare also existed within each of the characters, giving them their vitality, spirit, and action. Who is the spirit of these characters? Is it Shakespeare, or do these characters have a personal spirit independent of their creator? Do they have reality on their own, or do they represent the spiritual and mental power of their author? The law of paradox says that both propositions are true. Hamlet is both Hamlet and also Shakespeare, and yet Shakespeare is not identical with Hamlet. Hamlet may exclaim, "The spirit of my creator is within me, and yet I am not he." This truth gives sharp contrast to the often heard cries of, "I am God," which would be identical to Hamlet saying or shouting, "I am Shakespeare." The all is in the earthworm, yet the earthworm is far from being the all. And though the earthworm appears as a lowly being, it was created within the mind of the all. So, the all is immanent in the earthworm and all the particles of its makeup. Even these illustrations are inadequate, since they are creations of our finite minds, while the universe is a creation of infinite mind. The difference between the two poles separates them, yet it is merely a matter of degree, as the principles of correspondence remind us. As above, so below. as below, so above. To the degree that you realize the existence of spirit within your being, so will you rise in the spiritual scale of life. This is what spiritual development means. There are many planes of existence in the universe, with the lowest being dense matter and the upper being the spirit all. Everything is moving upward along the scale of life, as all progress is really a return to home. The all creates by projecting its will with the intention of becoming. This projection of the all's will then slows its vibration so that matter is created. This process is called involution, in which the all becomes involved or wrapped up with its creation. This is analogous to artists who forget their own existence while creating. The artists temporarily live within and through their creations and therefore transfer their life force to their artwork. I think a lot of us who, well, either if you're writing or if you're an artist, probably can really relate to what's being said here. So as you'll learn in regards to the principle of polarity, everything in the universe has a pole with two extremes of low and high energy at either end and degrees of energy in between. The involutionary stage of creation is sometimes called the outpouring of divine energy. The extreme pole of the creative process is the furthest from the all. The other extreme, called the evolutionary stage, which is known as indrawing, is the idea of coming home. This involutionary stage of creation is sometimes called the outpouring of divine energy, just as the evolutionary stage is called the indrawing of divine energy. The involutionary stage is the extreme pole of the creative process. It's considered to be the furthest removed from the all, while the beginning of the evolutionary stage is the closest. So as you'll read in regards to the principle of rhythm, everything in the universe swings pendulum-like along the poles described in the principle of polarity. During the all's outpouring of divine energy, the vibrations become subsequently lower until finally the momentum ceases. This is the beginning of the return pendulum swing to the evolutionary end of the creative pole. During the outpouring stage, the all's creative forces manifest as a compact whole. Then, during the evolutionary or indrawing stage, the creations become individualized. As the pendulum swings upward towards the highest vibration of the all upon the pole of creation, the individuals return to their source. The ancient Hermeticists used the word meditation to describe the process of mental creation of the universe in the mind of the all. They also used this phrase, divine attention, not intention, but attention, to describe the all's creative process, as the word attention comes from a Latin word meaning reaching out or extending. So divine attention means an extension of the all's mental energy. The Hermeticists used the term evolution to refer to the ascension or spiritual growth process. Evolution occurred first when the all meditated upon the beginning of the creation and established the material foundations of the universe by thinking it into existence. After this, the all gradually awakened from its meditation. Like a sleeping man slowly moving from a reclining to a standing position, the universe responded to the all's awakening by moving to higher energy vibrations. Eventually, the spirit of each soul is infinitely expanded, and the creator and the created are merged. Creation and evolution takes eons of earthly time, with each eon consisting of millions of years. Yet the universe's entire cycle of involution and evolution happen in the blink of an eye from the all's perspective. The illustration of the meditation and subsequent awakening from meditation of the all is only an attempt of the teachers to describe the infinite process by a finite example. And yet, as below, so above. The difference is merely in degree. And just as the all arouses itself from the meditation upon the universe, so do humans cease from manifesting upon the material plane and withdraw themselves more into their indwelling spirit. You may wonder why the All even creates universes. This question has been asked and pondered for ages. Some have imagined that the All had something to gain by it, but this is absurd. For what could the All gain that it didn't already possess? Others have proposed that the All wished something to love. Some believe that it created for pleasure or amusement because it was lonely or to manifest its power. Another theory is that the All was compelled to create by reason of its own internal nature and creative instinct. Yet, the idea of the All being compelled implies a force outside of itself, which is impossible. The theory also implies that the creative instinct would be the absolute instead of the All, which is also impossible. Yet, the All does create and manifest. The All's nature also seems to correspond to humanity's creative instincts, according to the principle of correspondence. The All could not act unless it willed to act, and it would not will to act unless it desired to act, and it would not desire to act unless it obtained some satisfaction from it. We still prefer to think that the All acted entirely free of any external or internal influences. There cannot be a reason for the All to act, for a reason implies that there's a cause. The All is above the principle of cause and effect, which is a law of the universe. It is not a law of the All. The only exception is when the All wills to become a cause, which sets the principle into motion. Since the All is unknowable, we are content to say that the All simply is. From this, we conclude that the All acts because it acts. The All is complete reason in itself, and also all law and action in itself. In other words, the All is its own reason, law, and action. Even further, the All is one with reason, law, and action. We believe that the answer to the question, why does the All create universes, is locked up in the inner self of the All, along with its secret of being. The principle of correspondence reaches only to the All's aspect of becoming. Behind that is the All's nature of being, in which all principles and laws are merged into oneness. Therefore, metaphysical speculation on this point is futile. We recognize the question. However, ordinary answers fade under logical examinations. Legend says that Hermes was asked the same question by advanced students, and then he would answer them by pressing his lips tightly together without uttering a word. This indicated there was really no answer. He may have also been conveying the following Hermetic axiom: the lips of wisdom are closed except to the ears of understanding, believing that even his advanced students did not possess the necessary understanding. At any rate, if Hermes possessed the secret, he didn't impart it. As far as the world is concerned, the lips of Hermes are still closed on this point. And if Hermes hesitated to answer the question, why would we suppose anyone else would know the answer? If the question is at all answerable, the Hermetic truth applies. While all is in the all, it is equally true that the all is in all. To him who truly understands this truth, hath come great understanding. So there's a lot to unpack just in this one little section. So the first part of this section pretty much tells us that the all is in everything, meaning that God, whatever you want to call it, this infinite living mind, is really omnipresent throughout every particle of the universe. It's a part of everything because it has created everything. So it is within us. But something else that they do state here is that we are not, you know, entirely the all. We are not God, but this energy, if you will, of the all lives inside of us. So that's one thing that they want to illustrate up front, even though they've often heard people say, you know, I guess other spiritual practitioners or gurus who, you know, will chant, I am God, I am God. In a way, I understand what that means, but what they're trying to say is you are not the infinite living mind. However, you are a part, you are a creation of the infinite living mind. You're an idea in the mind of God, which is completely true. The next thing that they talk about in this section, just to unpack it a little bit more, is this whole idea of creation and how the All, or God, creates through this process of involution and this process of evolution. So let's kind of break this down a little bit more. So in terms of how the All creates by projecting its will with the intention of something of becoming. And then whatever this intention is, it eventually has to slow down until it materializes, right? So the vibration has to be brought down because the all's energy, and I'm using this from what I've learned personally, vibrates so quickly that any creation from its own particular mental projection is instantaneous. Also because there's no such thing as time or space. Okay, so that energy has to be has to move very quickly. And thus the energy from God's mental projection, if you will, has to slow down. The momentum has to cease for something to solidify or materialize. Okay, so let's talk about these two processes, this involution and this evolution. So as I said, or what the Hermeticists kind of say here, if you can use this as an example to help visualize, that you have this creator called the All who, and I'm putting this in quotes, sitting down meditating and has an idea, if you will, projects some sort of mental image to create something, whatever that may be. Now, this projection or this outpouring of divine energy is called involution. Okay, so again, if we go back to this image of God sitting down, lotus position, projecting, you know, wanting to create something, and in its mind is kind of, you know, pouring out all of this divine energy towards a mental image, that process in itself is called involution. What the Hermeticists want you to know, and how they want you to visualize this whole process, is looking at a pole. A horizontal pole, because I think this is the best way to imagine this. So you have this horizontal pole or line, if you just draw this across a piece of paper, and on one end you have the source, the All, God, whatever you want to call it. The other end you kind of have matter. That's probably the best way to put it. And then you have all the space in between. Now on one end, because remember they say there's two extremes, right? You have matter and then you have like this infinite living mind called God. Now both have different vibrations. So I think for most of you listening, you probably already know this, but this is the best way I can illustrate it for you. So on one end you have quote unquote God, infinite living mind source, which vibrates so fast that we probably can't even comprehend it in a scientific way. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have matter, this very, very slow moving dense energy. Okay, so at the one spectrum with quote-unquote infinite living mind, the All, you have, for our purposes, you have this creative force called God sitting down, meditating, and outpouring all divine energy, okay? And this mental projection through which it's attributing all this energy to create it has to go through this whole process of involution, which means that once this image and this energy is projected, the energy has to eventually slow down. And the reason it has to slow down is because it's moving along this horizontal line to become matter. Now, this is interesting because when you think of the creation of the universe, which the Hermeticists do remind us that the universe itself is not the All. It is just a part of, it's a mental creation of the All. However, it is not tangible, right? So you have to remember that any creations from the All move along this spectrum. I hope this isn't too confusing. So the universe is a long part of the spectrum of energy and vibration. So once the All creates, if it is creating something into matter, the vibration behind it has to start to lose momentum enough for it to solidify, and then you have what is called matter. And then that becomes the process of evolution. So once something is created into matter, thus the process of involution ceases and the process of evolution begins. This is something that they're talking about in terms of how the all creates. Now, they also say in here to refer back to the principle of correspondence, because according to the principle of correspondence, they refer to the axiom, the one that we're all familiar with, as above, so below, as below, you know, so above, meaning that the processes of creation are similar. Even though we are not God, we can utilize, or we do utilize, excuse me, the same ways, the same tools of creation. It's just there are different degrees of creation. We cannot create as God creates explicitly, but we can still use the same laws to create to a certain degree. And what they're saying here is that even us, through mental projection, and this is something we already know as manifestation, right? We already know this, so this is nothing new for us. But what they're saying is that even through this whole process of, you know, meditation, the Hermeticists use the term evolution to refer to the ascension or spiritual growth process. So that's important to really understand. And I want to read this again because I think this is important from the initiates. Evolution occurred first when the all meditated upon the beginning of the creation and established the material foundations of the universe by thinking it into existence. After this, the all gradually awakened from its meditation, like a sleeping man slowly moving from a reclining to a standing position. The universe responded to the all's awakening by moving to higher energy vibrations, right? So when you think about this pole, moving back to the other end of the pole, from one extreme back to the other end to the source, the infinite living mind. So it's moving to higher energy vibrations, okay? Eventually, the spirit of each soul is infinitely expanded, and the created, are merged. So what's interesting here is a simple fact that everything must evolve. After the creator, after God, this infinite living mind, created all of this stuff, the universe, other things that solidified into matter, everything must evolve into something else. Right, as remember, energy is never destroyed. It evolves. It moves into some other form. It is the same thing with us and even with our own personal creations. They must evolve. However, according to this text, it must grow. It must grow along that same spectrum, but back towards the all, back towards the infinite living mind. And this is what I believe they call the indrawing, so that at some point, we, as living souls, must go back from whence we came, which is to the all, to experience true oneness. It's kind of interesting because in my own personal illustration, the evolutionary stage, I guess I see it moving, you know, in a stage of moving upward, if you will, not moving back. However, moving back to the source really is the whole process of our own individual evolution and ascension. So I think this is really something to sit down and try to figure out how to apply in our own daily lives, right? Because if you think about it, so far, what we've read in this book or what I've explained and reviewed, it doesn't really seem as if there are practical applications for daily life in this book. I'm hoping that we get there, but I do try to ground it here on Earth, since we are living beings and we are experiencing and creating here. But the one thing that I think I can say that does relate to the information I just reviewed is that all creations must go home at some point. And what does that mean, that all creations must kind of return home? Even your own mental creations, you must experience them. You must, because you're the home, you're the source of creation, you must experience your own mental projections. And I think that that's one way to kind of apply some of this information. All right, so I hope that that's a good summary to a certain extent. Now we are going to move into the principle of correspondence in more detail. So just to recap, remember that this principle of correspondence, the Kybalion summarizes this principle with Hermes' famous phrase, as above, so below, as below, so above. Now, this principle of correspondence refers to the three levels or planes of existence. These are physical, mental, and spiritual. Each plane vibrates at different rates, and these vibrational differences are the only distinguishing factors between planes. Otherwise, all three planes are aspects of the all. The higher spiritual planes vibrate the fastest, and the lower material planes vibrate the slowest, which is why matter appears dense and solid. The material plane is divided into subcategories of material, ethereal substance, and energy, with the latter having the fastest vibration. Similarly, the mental plane is subdivided into the mineral, plant, elemental, animal, and human mind, so from lower to higher vibrations. The mineral mind is the thought force within the mineral kingdom. The plant mind is the intelligence within plants and so forth. The spiritual plane also has its subcategories of angels, archangels, and deities. As above, so below also applies to the three planes and their subcategories. The Kybalion says there is a correspondence, harmony, and agreement between the several planes. The principle of correspondence, as well as the remaining principles of vibration, polarity, rhythm, cause and effect, which we'll get to, and gender, manifest and operate upon each plane. So this is a lot of information to digest. So we're going to go through some of the information about each plane shortly. According to the initiates, the second hermetic principle, which is the principle of correspondence, describes the harmony, agreement, and correspondence between the planes of manifestation, life, and being. Everything in the universe comes from the same source. So regardless of which plane something exists upon, it's subject to the same laws, principles, and characteristics as everything else. Hermetic philosophy holds that the universe is divided into three great classes of phenomena, known as the three great planes, which are the physical, mental, and the spiritual plane. These divisions are artificial and they are arbitrary, because the three planes are ascending degrees of the scale of life from the lowest point of matter to the highest point of spirit. The different planes shade into each other without hard distinctions between the higher phenomena of the physical and the lower of the mental, for example. So in short, the three great planes are groupings of degrees of life manifestation. The planes are neither places nor dimensions of space, even though we would think that. Yet they are more than states or conditions. The planes don't have the ordinary dimensions of length, depth, and breadth, but they do have a fourth dimension of vibration. The universe is in constant motion at different vibrational rhythms, speeds, rates, and directions. So the only variable separating one plane from another is really its vibration. The higher the vibrational rate, the higher the plane. Other than the vibrational differences, all of the planes are fundamentally the same as creations of the all existing within the mind, or within the infinite mind, let's just say that. Each of the three great planes are subdivided into seven minor planes, which are also subdivided into seven subplanes. So this is a lot of information here. All these divisions are arbitrary since they blend into each other. The divisions are mostly for convenience of study and thought. So we're going to go through each of these. We're going to kick this off with talking about the physical plane. The great physical plane and its seven minor planes includes everything physical and material, along with physics, energy, forces, and manifestations. So keep in mind that Hermetics view matter as a dense form of energy with slow vibrations, and I think we all in the metaphysical community, we know that. So Hermeticists classify matter under the category of energy and assign it three of the seven minor planes of the great physical plane. And so these are the seven minor physical planes as follows. You have the plane of matter, which is part A, the plane of matter part B, the plane of matter part C, which we will talk about, the plane of ethereal substance, the plane of energy, the plane of energy part B, and then the plane of energy part C. So let's go through all of these. And all of these subcategories fall under the physical plane. So right now we're only focusing on the subcategories of the physical plane before we move on to the other ones. The plane of matter, which is plane of matter A, includes matter in solids, liquids, and gases. The plane of matter type B comprises higher, subtler, and radiant forms of matter, such as radioactive waves and particles. The plane of matter C involves the most subtle and tenuous matter, the existence of which is not suspected by ordinary scientists, and I'll put yet after that. The plane of ethereal substance is composed of ether, an extremely elastic substance that pervades all universal space and which is the medium for energy waves. So following the plane of ethereal substance, we move into the other, those three categories of energy. So next is highest, in vibrational frequency is going to be the plane of energy. And this is going to be part A. This includes heat, light, magnetism, electricity, and attraction, such as gravity, cohesion, and chemical affinity. The plane of energy part B comprises higher forms of energy not yet discovered by science. This is known as nature's finer forces. They conduct the energy of mental phenomena such as telepathy. And then the last one, the plane of energy part C includes energy so highly organized that it bears many of the characteristics of life. This energy is only known to beings of the spiritual plane and to those who know and experience this plane while still living upon the earth. So that's everything under the category of the physical plane. Now we're moving into the mental plane. So the great mental plane includes living things known to us in ordinary life, as well as other forms known to, I guess we can say, occultists. As with the material plane, the mental plane is subdivided into 7 minor planes. So I know this is getting super technical, but please stick with it. And these are the plane of mineral mind, the plane of elemental mind, part A, the plane of plant mind, the plane of elemental mind, part B, the plane of animal mind, the plane of elemental mind, part C, and then the plane of human mind. So we're going to go into these subcategories. And this all falls under the category of the mental plane. So the plane of mineral mind, the first one, comprises the conditions of the entities that animate the minerals and chemicals. These entities are not to be confused with molecules and atoms, which are merely the material forms of these entities, just as a man's body is his material form and not himself. These entities may be called souls, who are living beings of slow vibration at a rate slightly faster than the living energy of the highest physical plane. The average person usually doesn't recognize the mind, soul, or life within the mineral kingdom. However, all occultists recognize this existence, and modern science is rapidly moving toward the point of view of the Hermetic, kind of in this respect. Molecules, atoms, and corpuscules have their likes and dislikes and attractions and repulsions. Some of the more daring scientists have postulated that the emotions and feelings of atoms differ only in degree from those of men. All occultists know this to be a fact. So now we're going to move on to the plane of the elemental mind, part A. This includes the most basic elemental beings. Although they are invisible to the ordinary senses of humans, they exist and play their part of the drama of the universe. Their degree of intelligence is between that of the mineral and chemical entities on the one hand, and the entities of the plant kingdom on the other. The plane of plant mind is composed of the kingdoms of the plant world. Plants have life, mind, and soul. The plane of elemental mind, part B, involves higher vibrating and more intelligent elementals than the elemental plane, part A. The plane of animal mind comprises the entities, beings, or souls animating the animal forms of life. The plane of elemental mind, C, are the highest vibrational and most intelligent elemental beings. And these are, and we're all familiar with the elemental beings for the most part, these are fairies, elves, leprechauns,
dare I even say trolls. I'm gonna throw that out there as well. So now we're gonna move to the last subcategory, which is the plane of the human mind. It is the human life, and it is human life and mentality. And this goes under the mental plane. This plane, like the others, has 7 subcategories, from the slowest vibrational rate of low intelligence to the highest rate of spiritual wisdom and intelligence. It has taken the human race millions of years to collectively reach the 4th subdivision of vibration and intelligence. Some advanced souls are vibrating at the level of the 5th, 6th, or 7th subdivisions. Some humans even exist on the lower levels of the next highest plane, called the Great Spiritual Plane. This is the last one we'll be discussing. The Great Spiritual Plane, like the other planes, has 7 subdivisions called minor planes, which also has 7 subdivisions of their own. This plane encompasses beings whose life, mind, and form vibrate at the highest rates. Humans who have reached the level of, and this is something that I'm pulling directly from the Kybalion, of an adept or avatar, are at the lowest subdivision of this plane. Above them are the angels, archangels, ascended masters, and deities. These unseen divinities and angelic helpers extend their influence freely and powerfully in the process of evolution and cosmic process. They also intervene and assist in human affairs. Yet even the highest of these advanced beings is still a creation existing in the mind of the all and is still subject to the universal laws. In that sense, they are still mortal because they belong to the universe and are subject to its conditions. According to the principle of correspondence, which embodies the axiom as above, so below, as below, so above, all of the 7 hermetic principles are in full operation on every plane of existence. There is a correspondence, harmony, and agreement between the planes, as above, so below, as below, so above. The centuries-old hermetic axiom embodies one of the great principles of universal phenomena. So to kind of sum this up, the Hermeticists really divide the world into these 3 planes, the physical, mental, and spiritual. And yes, they each have like 7 subcategories, which also have their own rate of vibration. Each plane operates by the same spiritual laws. So if you understand the laws governing one plane, you'll understand how the other planes operate. So by applying this understanding, you can elevate your consciousness and life to higher planes of existence. Now we're going to move on to the principle of vibration. So Hermes taught that everything constantly moves and never rests. Vibration is what distinguishes and differentiates the planes of correspondence that we just discussed. The all vibrates at a constant and steady high rate. The slowest vibratory rates are found in matter. The other planes of correspondence vibrate at rates in between these 2 extremes. The material plane is composed of vibrating atoms. If a material object was spun around, or if it vibrated fast enough, the human senses could no longer see or hear the object. The object would leave the material plane and move upward in frequency to the mental and spiritual planes. Similarly, you can raise the vibrations of objects and thoughts to move them to higher planes of existence. Each thought, emotion, or mental state vibrates at different frequencies, much like musical notes. Just as you can deliberately play a specific musical note, so can you choose to deliberately hold specific high vibrating thoughts, emotions, and even mental states. Every thought, emotion, and desire vibrates and attracts experiences of matching vibrations. If you'd like to attract better experiences, you must elevate your thoughts and emotions. The principle of vibration explains that you can polarize your mind at any vibrational degree you wish, and so gain, I guess you could say, perfect control over your mental states, your moods, and your experiences. A portion of your thought vibrations affects the minds of other people. This is a phenomenon called induction, or even telepathy. You can deliberately uplift the vibrations of those around you by elevating and radiating your positive thoughts. You can also change the vibrations of material objects to attract them into your life, to even fix broken items, or to release anything that's unwanted.
Those who study and practice this specific principle of vibration are using a higher law than what we kind of call physical laws, thereby seeming to defy gravity, even seeming to defy like time and space to accomplish what have been deemed like historically and even modern day as being miracles. So the Kybalion says, he who understands the principle of vibration has grasped the scepter of power. Now let's move on to what the initiates have to say about this principle of vibration. According to the Kybalion, nothing rests. Everything moves, everything vibrates. Again, this is something that we know to be truth, even verified by scientists today. This hermetic principle embodies the truth that motion is manifest in everything in the universe. Nothing is at rest, everything moves, vibrates, and circles. This hermetic principle was recognized by Greek philosophers who embodied it in their systems. But then for centuries, this principle was essentially forgotten. It was rediscovered in the 19th century when scientists unlocked the secrets of atoms and radioactivity. Science now realizes that matter and energy are modes of vibratory motion, and soon science will discover the same with mental phenomena. That's very exciting to read that, because I can't wait for that quote-unquote discovery unless it's already been made. The differences between the various manifestations within the universe are due entirely to varying vibrational rates. Even the all manifests a constant and intensely rapid vibration. Spirit is at one end of the pole of vibration, and the other pole is extremely dense and slow vibrating forms of matter. This is something we already kind of discussed earlier. So if you can go back to that visualization in your mind about that horizontal pole where there's two points of this pole, and on either end you have matter and then you have spirit / infinite mind, God. So between these two poles are millions of different rates and modes of vibration. Daily life provides concrete examples of the effects of increased vibrations. As musical notes get higher in pitch, their vibrational rate increases. Eventually, the notes and vibrations are so high that they are imperceptible. Colors are actually another example. Red is the lowest vibrational color of the human eye, that the human eye can see, and violet is at the top of the spectrum. There are even higher notes, colors, and energies that are beyond human perception. When an object vibrates fast enough, its molecules disintegrate and resolve themselves into the original atoms. Then the atoms following the principle of vibration are separated into the countless electrons and protons of which they are composed. With a high enough frequency of vibration, even these elements will eventually scatter. The remaining essence of the object is then composed of ethereal substance. The faster vibrations liberate the object's light, heat, and other energy from its previously confining molecules and atoms. If the vibrations were further increased, the dematerialized object would climb the successive mental and spiritual planes until it finally would re-enter the all. So just as a musical note may be reproduced by causing an instrument to vibrate at a certain rate, so can mental states be reproduced at will. In other words, you can control your mental state and lift your vibrations at any level you choose. Every thought, emotion, reason, will, desire, or mental state is accompanied by vibrations, a portion of which affects the minds of other people through induction. This produces telepathy and other forms of psychic phenomena and mental influence. With a little reflection, you'll see that this principle of vibration underlies this phenomena and power manifested by, I guess you can say, masters and adepts in the past who set aside natural laws. In reality, they are simply using one law against another to accomplish the results. They have learned to change the vibrations of material objects and other forms of energy and perform quote-unquote miracles. Remember this specific hermetic axiom: he who understands the principle of vibration has grasped. So I think in this section, in terms of this principle of vibration, and again, these are laws that are no longer new to those of us who have been studying manifestation in any form for some time, the whole idea of raising your thoughts to a very high level of vibration is obviously very useful. like you know, when you're told to manifest, you're told to create a vision board, stay positive, etc. Keep, you know, within your mind this high vibrational thought or mental image, and keep your emotions at that level as well in order to manifest something into being, to materialize it. What the Kybalion is saying here is essentially the same, with one exception, is that, again, you have this pole of extremes, and when they're talking about spirit / God, they're saying that spirit is at one pole, and then you have extreme density, really slow vibrating forms of matter at the other end of this pole. And since the all manifests a constant and intensely rapid vibration and creates at that level, I have yet to reconcile this for myself, but what I can gather from this is that in order for us to create what the Kybalion says that masters in the past, that adepts have created, you know, performed miracles, it is because they were able to manifest at the same level, or at least as close as they could to that end of the spectrum, meaning that they were able to keep their mind and emotions in check to the point where whatever it is they were trying to create was extremely within an extreme positive mental framework. That is probably the best way I can describe it, meaning that they were not affected by external forces. Somebody saying something really crappy to them didn't throw them off their game, so to speak. Instead, when they had a desire, a will to create something, bring something into being, they were able to keep themselves at that one end of the spectrum to bring it into being. And I feel like that's what the Kybalion is pretty much saying to us. Whenever you're trying to bring something into this world, and I say, because this is my addendum to it, if it is for your highest good and in your blueprint for this lifetime, and you're allowed to do so, the way to bring it in faster is to keep yourself very uplifted, etc. But if you're having a hard time doing that, which most of us are because of the program negative self-talk that we have from childhood all the way through partially adulthood, then it is useful to look at this technique to kind of, again, draw this horizontal line on a piece of paper and really, I would say, outline where you're at. Are you focusing more on the energy that is affiliated with this, you know, material world, which is very dense? Or are your thoughts more associated to the other end of the spectrum? And kind of mapping that out for yourself and seeing how you can get from here to there is probably one of the most useful tools that you can do. And asking why it is that you feel you are totally incapable of bringing what it is that you desire into being. Okay, let's move on to the principle of polarity. So this principle could also be called the principle of practicality, since it offers a profoundly practical tool for living, manifesting, healing, and practicing any kind of quote-unquote magic. So the first three principles really, I would say, have discussed how the material, mental, and spiritual planes are from the same energy, which the Hermeticists, of course, we know now, call the All. The differences in planes are purely because they vibrate at different rates. So this fourth principle, this one of polarity, states that everything has two polarities or extremes. These seeming opposites are part of the same pole, and they're just situated at different ends. So for example, hot and cold are extremes of the pole called temperature. So the Kybalion specifically says the differences between things diametrically opposed to each other is merely a matter of degree, even though it doesn't seem that way. So in between the two polarities of hot and cold are countless degrees of warmth and coolness. It's the same way with every apparent opposite: hard and soft, noisy and quiet, light and dark, good and bad, love and fear. When you find one thing, you'll also find the potential for its opposite. The principle of polarity empowers you to transmute an undesirable situation to the other end of the pole and manifest a desirable situation or outcome. If something undesirable is present in your life, it means that its opposite is also present, which is super powerful knowledge for everyone. This principle works by lifting your mental vibrations to a higher level to banish the undesirable and attract the desirable. So let's use the wonderful example of money, our friend. So on one end of the money pole is prosperity, where you have as much money as you could possibly even desire. Poor is going to be at the other end, when there isn't enough money to meet your needs. In between these two extremes are countless financial situations in between poverty and prosperity. So if you worry about money or complain that you don't have enough, your thoughts are obviously toward the poverty end of the pole. Consequently, that's what you're going to attract. Even if you don't seem to have money right now, you can use the principle of polarity to improve your financial situation. So I want you guys to imagine a lever sliding up and down this money pole. So the way we kind of talked about that horizontal pole of extremes earlier, now I want you to kind of flip that pole over so that it's vertical and put prosperity on one end, poverty on the other end. So I want you to imagine a lever sliding up and down this money pole. And there are degrees in between these poles, so make sure you put little dashes in between. So to attract more money, you can adjust your vibration upward by visualizing that the lever is at the highest possible location along the pole. Since this pole is in your mind, it's your creation. Therefore, it's your personal money pole. Even if you're worried about money right now, you can mentally will the lever to move up higher. That visualization can immediately attract windfalls of prosperity, provided that you monitor the lever's position to ensure that it stays at the upper ends of the pole. So if you have difficulty imagining prosperity, then mentally push the lever on the money pole to the highest position that you can imagine manifesting in reality. So there's no point in asking you to visualize something that you can't accept as a real possibility. Yet, any improvement in elevating your lever up the money pole will have a positive effect on your finances. This is true even if you can only imagine pushing your lever up one notch above its current situation. Keep monitoring the money pole and push the lever up as high as you feel comfortable. The minute that you believe that prosperity is possible, you'll allow the level to reach the top of this pole. So, of course, you can also imagine a pole that controls your beliefs about money in other areas of your life. Keep your levers high at the top of these poles to release old limiting beliefs about money, love, etc. So everything that you desire has a pole assigned to it, whether it's health, inner peace, again, money, love, etc. And you can use this exercise and imagine a whole series of poles with sliding levers. The initiates have a lot to say about this principle of polarity, but I'm going to condense it into a couple of sections that I think are most relevant and most helpful for us today. So according to them, good and bad are also relative. We call one end of the scale good and the other bad. A thing is less good than the thing higher up the scale. However, that less good thing in turn is more good than the thing below it, and so on. And so it is on the mental plane. Love and hate are generally regarded as diametrically opposed to each other and unreconcilable. But as we apply the principle of polarity, we find that there is no such thing as absolute love or absolute hate as distinguished from each other. They are merely terms applied to the two poles of the same thing. Beginning at any point of the scale, we find more love or less hate as we ascend, and more hate or less love as we descend. There are degrees of love and hate and a middle point where like and dislike become indistinguishable. Courage and fear come under the same rule. These pairs of opposites exist everywhere, and wherever you find one thing, you'll find its opposite at the other extreme of the same pole. This fact enables you to transmute one mental state into another along the lines of polarization. Things belonging to different classes cannot be transmuted into each other, but things of the same class may have their polarity changed. So love never becomes east or west or red or violet, but love may and often does turn into hate. Likewise, hate may be transformed into love by changing its polarity. Courage may be transmuted into fear and the reverse. Hard things may be rendered soft. Dull things become sharp. Hot things become cold. It's all the same process. The transmutation always involves things of the same kind of different degrees. So let's take an example here. Take the case of a fearful man. By raising his mental vibrations along the line of fear and courage, he can be filled with the highest degree of courage and fearlessness. And likewise, the slothful person may change himself into an active, energetic individual simply by polarizing along the lines of the desired quality. The two ends of the poles may be classified as positive and negative. Love is positive to the negative hate, positive courage to negative fear, positive activity to negative non-activity, and so forth. The positive pole is of a higher degree than the negative and readily dominates it. The tendency of nature is in the direction of dominant activity of the positive pole. So you see that you can change your mental state by moving upward towards the positive pole, and that nature will help you along. So in addition to changing the poles of your own conditions, this principle of polarization allows you to also influence another's mind to elevate their mental status. And remember, this is the whole idea of induction, which is also called telepathy. Mental induction means that material states may be produced by induction from others. So a higher mental vibrational rate may be communicated to another person, elevating the polarity of that person's mental state. This is how the majority of mental treatments occur. For instance, let's say that a person is depressed and filled with fear. A mental scientist uses his or her will to increase the vibration of his or her mind. Then he or she extends this positive vibration to the other person to produce a similarly high vibration through induction. This raises the other person's vibrations and results in polarization at the positive end of the scale. Fear and other negativity are transmuted into courage and similar positive mental states. So to kind of sum up this principle explains that every experience and choice is the same in truth. What appears to be opposite is actually the same, but with different degrees of the same ingredients. Prosperity and poverty are not opposites. They are merely ends of the same pole, vibrating at different rates. So each situation, again, in your life has a pole, with extremes at either end and vibrational increments in between. The Hermeticist really used this principle to transmute unwanted situations and emotions into something more desirable, merely by changing their vibration to the highest end of each of these poles. Let's go ahead and move on now to the principle of rhythm. I know I've been bombarding you guys with a ton of information, but we will reconcile all of this at the end. So the principle of rhythm ties together the principles of correspondence, vibration, and polarity. So this principle states that everything moves pendulum-like up and down these poles that we've kind of discussed. The cycle of life illustrates these rhythms with birth, life, death, and rebirth. Ocean tides and seasons are other really good examples of this. So the Hermeticists say that the principle of rhythm explains changes in moods, feelings, and experiences. So the two ends of our personal mental plane poles are higher and lower consciousness, or we can say the higher self and the ego. So until we become aware of the principles of polarity and rhythm, the pendulum swings back and forth between the higher and lower selves. So it can feel as if we literally have like no control over our thoughts and the resulting circumstances. The Hermeticists have learned how to neutralize this tendency by making the conscious decision to be unaffected by these pendulum swings of life. And so the Kybalion kind of puts it this way. The Hermetic master or advanced student polarizes himself or herself at the desired pole, and by a process akin to refusing to participate in the backward swing, or if you prefer, a denial of its influence over him, he stands firm in his polarized position and allows the mental pendulum to swing back along the unconscious plane. So, as I said earlier, it's kind of good to create these poles of like one of money that has two ends of the spectrum, prosperity and poverty. And then we have health. On one end is illness, the other end is perfect health. And then for love, we have true love being one end, loneliness being the other end. For career, we have a fulfilling career at one end, meaningless work at the other end. And then even for something like your psychic abilities, you have clear psychic abilities and then blocked on the other end. The principle of rhythm says that in life, you are going to experience changes and fluctuations. It's just kind of like the natural rhythm of life. But when you kind of refer back to these visualizations of these poles, it can help you in a number of ways because it shows you that there is indeed a spectrum of experiences in between these two extremes, and to keep that at the forefront of your mind. So if you're kind of somebody who's a fatalist, and if you have like one bad situation in life, or excuse me, if you experience a bad situation unexpectedly, maybe you have a tendency to assume that your whole life is going to fall apart in the blink of an eye because of that. However, you know, if this is a situation about money, health, love, career, if you kind of have these poles in your face to refer to, then you'll see, oh, well, where am I along this spectrum? It's likely that I'm not necessarily going to fall to the other extreme overnight. There are gradations in between. I think that's a very helpful visualization. So according to the Kybalion, an understanding of the workings of this specific principle will give one the key to the mastery of these rhythmic swings of feeling. So in other words, the power of your decision can help you ride a continual tide of upward swings. So let's see what the initiates have to say about this principle. The principle of rhythm embodies the truth that everything moves in measured motion. This could also be described as a to and from movement, a flow and inflow, a swing forward and backward, a pendulum-like movement, a tide-like ebb and flow, and a high tide and a low tide. This steady movement occurs along the poles within the physical, mental, and the spiritual planes. The principle of rhythm is closely connected with the principle of polarity, which we've already talked about. Rhythm swings between the two poles, which are established by this principle of polarity. This does not mean, however, that the pendulum of rhythm swings to the extreme poles. This rarely happens. So in fact, it's difficult to establish the extreme polar opposites in the majority of cases. But the swing forever goes toward the direction of the poles' extremes, even if it never reaches them. There's always an action and reaction, an advance and retreat, and a rising and sinking manifested in all of the planes of the universe. Suns, worlds, men, animals, plants, minerals, forces, energy, mind, matter, and even spirit manifest this principle. Rhythm manifests in the creation and destruction of worlds, in the rise and fall of nations, in the life history of all things, and in the mental states of humans. Universes begin and end with the exhaling and the inhaling of the all. Universes are created, reach their extreme point of materiality, and then begin their upward swing toward spirit. Suns spring into being, achieve their height of power, and the process of retrogression begins. After eons, they become dead masses of matter, awaiting another impulse to spark their inner energies into activity to begin a new solar life cycle. All the worlds are born, grow, and die, only to be reborn. This is how it is with everything swinging from action to reaction and from birth to death. Every being goes through the cycle of birth, growth, maturity, decadence, death, and then birth. The swing of the pendulum is evident, everywhere. So just to put this into perspective, if we think of the days and we think of the seasons, night follows day, day, and then day, you know, follows night. The pendulum swings from summer to winter and back again. And then when we look at the electrons, atoms, molecules, and all masses of matter swing around the circle of their nature. There is no such thing as absolute rest or cessation from movement. So this principle has universal application. It can be applied to any question, phenomena, and all phases of human activity. The principle of rhythm is well understood by even modern science and is considered a universal law applicable to material things. However, the Hermeticists kind of carry this forward a little bit more. Its manifestations and influence extend to human mental activities. It accounts for the bewildering succession of moods, feelings, and other annoying and perplexing changes that we notice in ourselves. By studying this principle, the Hermeticists have learned to escape from troublesome rhythms through the process, again, we've talked about earlier, of transmutation. So there are two other laws that they follow up in this section, which is the law of neutralization and then the law of compensation. I believe that's what it's called. Yes, that we'll talk about, and then we'll get to the very last two principles that we have in the Kybalion. So let's talk about the law of neutralization. According to these initiates, there were two general planes of consciousness, the lower and the higher. You can rise to the higher plane and escape the swing of the rhythmic pendulum on the lower plane. You do this with the law of neutralization, which means having a conscious awareness of the principle of rhythm's effect upon your mental states. Without this conscious awareness, you are subject to the pendulum swings of mental states and moods without knowing why. The law of neutralization is akin to rising above a thing and letting it pass beneath you. You polarize yourself at the desired pole and then refuse to participate in the backward swing. This helps you to stay stable and be unaffected as the mental pendulum swings back along the unconscious plane. All individuals who have attained any degree of self-mastery, they accomplish this, more or less sometimes unknowingly. By refusing to allow their moods and negative mental states to affect them, they apply this law. The master, however, carries this to a much higher degree of proficiency. Through the use of will, the master attains a steady degree of poise and mental centeredness without being swung backward and forward by the mental pendulum of moods and feelings. You too can attain this through practice and commitment. So if you've been a creature of moods, feelings, and emotion in the past, you can alter this course and have mastery over yourself. Consider how much these swings of rhythm have affected your life and how your enthusiasm has been invariably followed by feelings of depression. Likewise, your periods of courage were likely succeeded by equal moods of fear. Perhaps you never suspected that your feelings rose and fell like tides according to natural law. An understanding of the workings of this principle can give you mastery over these rhythmic swings of feeling. This enables you to know yourself better and avoid being carried away by inflows and outflows. This will is superior to the conscious manifestation of this principle, although the principle itself can never be destroyed. You may escape its effects, but the principle operates nevertheless. The pendulum ever swings, although you may avoid being carried along with it. So let's talk about the law of compensation here. It's the last thing they talk about in this section. So this principle of rhythm incorporates the law of compensation. One of the definitions of the word compensate is to counterbalance, and this is how the Hermeticists choose to apply it. When the Kybalion says, the measure of the swing to the right is the measure of the swing to the left, rhythm compensates, it is referring to this law. The law of compensation holds that the swing in one direction determines the swing in the opposite direction. One swing balances and the other counterbalances. We may see many examples of this
here on the physical plane. So for instance, the pendulum of the clock swings a certain distance to the right and then an equal distance to the left. The seasons balance each other in the same way. Ocean tides kind of do the same. So when the pendulum swings a short distance in one direction, the backward swing is equally short. Long swings to and fro are also equivalent to one another. The law of compensation applies to both the material and even the mental planes. So a person who experiences great suffering has more capability of feeling great joy because of the extreme swings. In contrast, a person with blunted emotions won't feel extreme pain or joy. The capacity for pain and pleasure is balanced within each individual. Hermeticists teach that before we can enjoy great pleasure, we must have swung as far proportionately toward the other pole of the feeling. This does not mean that bad follows good. In fact, the opposite is true, as the negative precedes the positive. Pleasure is the rhythmic swing that compensates for pain previously experienced in this life or past lives. This throws a new light on the problem of pain. So it's entirely possible, as many have supposedly done in the past, to escape the rhythmic swing toward pain by the process of neutralization previously described. By consciously rising to the higher mental plane, much of the experience that comes from the lower plane is avoided and escaped. This will require commitment and practice on your part, but the results are well worth any effort involved. So according to this principle, just to break it down and simplify, the universe operates in precise and predictable rhythms. If you allow these rhythms to master you, then your moods and your life will fluctuate up and down. However, by mastering the rhythms, you become immune to downward turns in emotions or life experiences, according to the Hermeticists. So now let's just review the last two principles here. And this is the principle of cause and effect, and then the principle of gender. We've all heard of cause and effect, so I'm sure this is nothing new to all of us. The principle of cause and effect states that nothing happens by chance. Everything in the universe has an identifiable cause. When something appears to occur by chance, it means that the cause is unrecognized. Causes aren't creators of events or circumstances. They're catalysts in a long chain of them, usually driven by underlying beliefs about life and the way that it is. So for instance, if you believe that you won't be hired for your dream job, you'll never apply for it. Yet this belief is only one factor in a chain of causes. So for instance, where did the belief come from? If you say, well, my parents modeled it for me, then there's still the question of where your parents acquired this belief. So there's no point in tracing through chains of events in search of a primary cause. The important and the more helpful point is to develop an awareness of this principle in your own life. So without an awareness of cause and effect, you may be unduly influenced by external factors, such as the desires of those exerting willful force in your direction. Hermetics say that you can't change or stop the principles and the laws. You can, however, use higher will to prevail against the lower will. A conscious awareness of cause and effect, combined with intention and practice, helps you rise above external influences. The Kybalion says that this conscious awareness helps us to become movers in the game of life instead of pawns, causes instead of effects. So one thing I want to say is for you to notice any strong thoughts or feelings that you may have throughout the day. These can be thoughts and feelings that just seem to pop out of nowhere. Be aware also of recurring thoughts and feelings, especially those involving very strong feelings. So as you notice these intense thoughts and feelings, immediately visualize your mental, visualize the mental pole that you have associated with those. Observe whether the pole levers have slid downward or whether they remain upward in response to your strong feelings and your thoughts. And remember to use your free will to lift any levers that have slid down this pole. The action of keeping your levers high is a cause that yields desirable effects.
So let's see what the initiates have to say about cause and effect. So this sixth hermetic principle embodies the truth that law pervades the universe. Nothing happens by chance. In fact, chance indicates that an unrecognized cause exists. This principle of cause and effect underlies all scientific thought and was enunciated by Hermetic teachers in the earliest days. Philosophers throughout the ages have all agreed about this principle, arguing only about the details of its operation. The underlying principle of cause and effect has been accepted by practically all the influential thinkers of the world. A little consideration will show that there's no such thing as chance. So if we look at the dictionary, Webster's defines the word chance as something that happens unpredictably without discernible human intention or observable cause. The assumed purposeless determiner of unaccountable happenings. Yet how could an agent such as chance exist independent of the universal laws, order, and continuity? Such an agent would be entirely independent of the orderly universe and therefore superior to it. Nothing outside the all could be outside of universal law because the all is law itself. There is no room in the universe for something outside of and independent of law. The existence of such a thing would render all natural laws ineffective and would plunge the universe into chaos and disorder and even lawlessness. So they go on to say that there is always a cause and a because to every event. Nothing ever happens without a cause, or rather a chain of causes. No event creates another event, but is merely a link in the great orderly chain of events flowing from the creative energy of the all. There is a continuity between everything that has gone before and everything that follows. So on the higher and lower planes, the law is always in operation. There is no such thing as chance, and everything is governed by universal law. The infinite number of laws are manifestations of the one great law, the law which is the all. So summing up this principle, this is the Hermeticists and the initiates pretty much say this is a perfectly ordered universe, and nothing happens by chance or even accident. There's always a cause behind every effect, and life mastery occurs when you become a conscious cause of the effects you desire, instead of being carried along by the wills and the desires of other people in your life. So you can use this principle to effect healings and even manifestations. The very last principle that we're going to cover is the principle of gender. When the Hermeticists use the term gender, they're referring to masculine and feminine energies that combine to create manifestations. Gender has nothing to do with the physical sexual attributes. Every person, thing, and situation has both the masculine and feminine energies. A woman has inner male and female energy, and likewise with a man, it's the same. Masculine energy sends itself outward into the world. Feminine energy is receptive and attracting. Outwardly projecting masculine energies are called positive, and receptive feminine energies are called negative. The terms positive and negative aren't used in the usual sense of like good and bad. They refer only to the direction in which energy flows, like the plus and minus signs of a battery. So the principle of gender works on all of these same three planes of correspondence: the physical, mental, and the spiritual. On the mental plane, masculine energy is expressed as the conscious mind, and feminine energy is the unconscious mind. So when we talk about mental gender here, the Hermeticists distinguish between the me and the I within each person. So your me is a combination of your moods, mental states, habits, and your body. It's your feminine energy. Your I is the being within you who can will the me to act according to its wishes, its desires, intentions. It's your masculine energy. So many people identify only with their me state. They feel victimized and constricted by the me's vacillating moods. The me isn't undesirable, though. In fact, it has creative energy force within it. However, the me needs to be balanced with the I, the male and the female together, to use the creative force in consistent ways. The feminine mental principle, the me energy, is receptive and generates new ideas that your masculine mental principle, the I energy, puts into action. So if you can detach from identifying with your me and instead identify with your I, you can then send energy and direction to the me. Your me and I will then team up to manifest the me's wonderful ideas into reality. The I is the force that makes sure that all the levers on the console are kept constantly high. Even when they slip down, the I can observe and correct this. Telepathy and other psychic phenomena can also be explained and improved through this principle of gender. So telepathy occurs when a thought is sent, which is a masculine action, by one person, and then received, which is a feminine action, by another person. Telepathy can further be developed through practicing receptiveness, such as asking others to help you and saying yes to gifts and offers of assistance. So often people who are psychically blocked and unable to like see or feel their angels or other guides, etc., are those who are such generous givers that they rarely allow themselves to receive. This makes them unbalanced in their male energy, and so it's difficult for them to relax and become aware of the inflow of spirit. People who have competitive or even high-stress jobs often get overly situated in their male energy. Another psychic block occurs when a person tries too hard to make a psychic vision happen. Striving is a male energy. Receptiveness is the female energy required to receive psychic impressions. So too much male energy can block you from receiving spiritual messages. An imbalance of too much feminine energy is equally unhealthy, often resulting in a passive personality who merely observes life rather than acting upon or expressing original thoughts and ideas. Balanced energy is the healthiest, both for psychic development and also for manifestation in any kind of way. So this really sums up the seven principles here in the Kybalion that the initiates address. They really go into this whole section of gender, but I'll allow you to read that for yourself. I try to sum it up as best I could. At the very end of the Kybalion, there's this whole section on hermetic axioms, which I think are really important to go back and take a look at them to see how, you know, to interpret them for yourselves and see how you can apply them to your everyday life. But as a whole, the Kybalion offers both philosophical and practical insights that can assist you with really anything. So these seven principles help to chart your emotions, your health, and even the material world. The more you study these principles, the more you'll see examples of them in everyday situations. That's when hermetics begins to make sense and become incorporated into your life. So hermetics kind of shares this whole good news that your life can be filled with all of the things that you desire, and that your moods and your energy levels can be consistently elevated, and that you have all the means to live a creative and prosperous life. Since everything in your life is a product of your mind, you can use these tools of hermetics to make any desired alterations. So for example, anytime you experience an upsetting situation, remember that if the negative is present, so must the positive also be present, or the positive desirable outcome must be present. So mentally check that example that I gave you, those poles, and check your levers on the poles. Push the levers all the way to the top or as high as your beliefs will allow. This is a visual representation of the hermetic law of neutralization, which says you can use your will to decide against being pulled downward in your moods, energy, or even your situations. When your thoughts are elevated, you attract and manifest more desirable outcomes. And make sure to keep monitoring, these poles to ensure that the levers on every area of your life stay high. This will help you to transmute undesirable situations into desirable situations really without any strain. Well, you guys, we have covered a ton of information. Some of it is very dense and a little boring, I think, for some people. And getting through a lot of that has definitely been a task. But I think the Kybalion is a very useful esoteric tool, especially when it comes to transmutation of the negative into the positive in many aspects of our life. I want to thank you so much for listening. I did put a link to a free copy of the Kybalion in the description section of the podcast this week. Thank you again for joining me today for the second part of the Kybalion, and I believe this will probably be the last podcast before 2020, so I wish you all a wonderful new year, and I look forward to bringing you new books and titles and new guests next year. Thank you all, and have a wonderful Christmas and New Year. In addition, this principle of gender can help you generate new ideas and then put them into action. This principle can help you overcome self-doubt or even procrastination tendencies, which I think a lot of us have. And that feminine energy is receptive and eternally patient, which is why it sometimes appears passive and unmotivated. So your inner masculine energy, we have to remember, loves taking action.